Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and Now. Americans await the return of loved ones evacuated from Beirut. We'll speak to a father in Dearborn, Michigan in a moment. But first, President Bush is poised to use his veto power for the first time in his presidency today. The president is expected to veto legislation that would have expanded federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Press Secretary Tony Snow says the president believes it's inappropriate for the federal government to finance something that many people consider murder. The bill has sparked emotionally charged debate, divided Republicans, and could impact the midterm elections. Rick Klein is congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Capitol Hill. And Rick, first, remind us exactly what's in the bill.
The bill would vastly expand the federal dollars that are available to people to do experimentation on embryonic stem cells. The stem cells we're talking about here would be derived from embryos that would be discarded by in vitro fertilization clinics and that the donor parents say they no longer want and have no problem with experimenting on. However, the reason that there's a moral dilemma here is, as the president points out pretty often, is that these are considered by a lot of people to be human life. They are fertilized embryos, and the president feels like this is a moral line that should not be crossed regardless of what's going to eventually happen to these embryos.
The embryonic stem cells hold great promise for cures and treatments for diseases, but people who oppose it say you could use other cells and not destroy the embryo. Well, congressional leaders have vowed to schedule a vote on a veto override. If the president, as expected, signs a veto, when might the override come, and will it come? Will there be enough votes?
The attempt will come tonight, and almost certainly there will not be enough votes, and that's why it's happening as quickly as it is. You need a two-thirds majority to override a presidential veto, and when it came up in the House, they were about 50 votes short. In the Senate, where they just approved it yesterday, they were 4 votes short of the two-thirds majority. So it may be close, but I think the people expect the House vote to be pretty similar to what it was a year ago, and that'll be the end of it, and that'll be the end of it at least for the end of this year.
And yet it might not be the end of it politically. We have midterm elections coming up. Polls show that as many as 70% of Americans agree with this type of legislation. So if the presidential veto stands, what sort of political backlash might his party face?
Could be a major issue in a lot of swing districts. You know, it's been a big issue so far in a governor's race in Wisconsin, and a Senate race in Missouri, in several House races in Connecticut, and it will continue to build. I think what Democrats are saying and some of the president's critics on this is that you can't make this issue go away. The veto is going to may keep it down for a little while, may delay this research by a few months, but this remains a potent political issue and something that will be happening scientifically.
And by the way, Rick, we wanted to note that while the president has never used his veto before, your paper has reported extensively on a device known as a presidential signing statement. The president has used many of these. It asserts that he has the power to set aside any statute passed by Congress when it conflicts with his interpretation of the Constitution. He's used the power to disobey laws more than 750 times. So what would it mean that he is now using a veto and not merely another signing statement?
This is a very straightforward, only a two-page bill. It would be difficult for him to sign it and then disavow portions of it because there isn't much in it beyond what we know about it. The other thing is, I mean, I think there is a symbolic significance to the president deciding to make this his first veto. Obviously, he doesn't choose what reaches his desk, but this is an issue that he's long wrestled with publicly and privately. And for him to make this statement shows some consistency on his part, according to the White House folks, people behind him, and also something that the conservative base is pretty excited about.
It's a statement he wants to make publicly.
I think that's right.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe, talking to us about the president's planned veto of legislation that would have expanded federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. He's expected to cast that veto this afternoon. Rick, thanks.
Thank you.
And now to the Middle East, starting with Lebanon. A cruise liner has sailed out of Beirut's port carrying more than 1,000 American evacuees. In a moment, we'll speak to a Michigan man who's waiting at home for his two young sons. But first, we turn to Peter Heath, acting president and provost of the American University of Beirut. He issued the notice to evacuate at his school. And Peter, we're in day 7 of fierce fighting between Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. But long before this current crisis, the U.S. advised Americans to avoid traveling to Lebanon. Some of your students have evacuated. Others, including Americans, have stayed. Were they aware of the difficulties when they came there that they might face there?
Definitely. And the State Department warning is rather precise, and they say we warn against visiting the country, but especially in specific areas, remarkably the south and southern Beirut, the very areas that have been hit. But I've been here for 8 years, and it's been probably as safe on a day-to-day basis as any other place.
So this is, you know, despite the warnings, this, I'm imagining this is coming as quite a shock to people.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a week ago, we were heavily engaged in strategic planning for the next 5 years. The country was looking forward to the best tourist season that it had in 30 years. And all of a sudden, within 2 days, it's all gone.
Yeah. Now that the evacuation is underway, what are the concerns of those of you who remain behind?
Well, I think the Israeli attack is really on two levels. One is a targeted response on Hezbollah military capability. But the second is creating a blockade situation for the country where essential supplies are not coming in. So our primary concern right from the second day of the attack, beyond the personal safety of students and staff and faculty, was fuel. No fuel is coming into the country, and these spectacular pictures that one sees of smoke coming up are basically fuel depots. So the more fuel depots that are hit in the country, the less fuel there is. We have a 350-bed academic medical hospital that train medical students in, which is the most advanced in certainly in Lebanon. And without fuel, we do have our own electrical plant, but without fuel, the electricity stops, and the hospital stops as well. Beyond that, for the country has about a 20-day supply of fuel, as far as we can figure out. And if there's no fuel in the country, then, in fact, the water system stops. Our second main concern is the refugee problem, because large numbers of poor people from the south are coming up into Beirut, which is a much wealthier area. So not only do you have the problems of refugees, but you have the problems of differences of social class.
Do you worry about the safety of American students who stay?
If this situation develops for another couple of weeks, we're going to have more and more angry people coming up into Beirut. And I'm less worried about an organized response by any particular political group than some very upset and angry 19-year-old who is walking around with a gun in the streets of Lebanon in a week and sees an American and thinks, well, it's these guys who've done it to us.
Well, Peter Heath at American University in Beirut, what do you think of unconfirmed reports today that the U.S. is telling Israel to go ahead and bomb Lebanon for about another week to try to weaken Hezbollah before the international community will come in?
Well, I think at this point that there's a kind of cold war going on between groups in the Middle East that are mainly identified around Islamic fundamentalism, and groups more sympathetic to the West, whether they're in the West, such as the United States, or countries such as Jordan or Egypt. So in this Cold War, on one level, this is the fight between Israel and Hezbollah, but on a greater level, it's a proxy war between the United States and Iran, and I think both sides are kind of looking at who's going to blink first, and therefore, from the Americans' point of view, it's very important to show firmness, and the Israelis, I think, feel that it's important that they show firmness.
You know, this bombing is being sort of tacitly okayed by the world, and here you are sitting there with, you know, the walls shaking.
Well, it's a shock for the whole country. As I said, you know, we are an institution that tries to provide excellent education in the American model with all the American values, and unfortunately, universities and wars do not go well together. We've basically lost 8 years of hard work and planning in about 2 weeks, or actually 1 week now.
Peter Heath, thanks very much.
Okay.
Peter Heath, Provost and Acting President of the American University of Beirut. Well, 10-year-old Mazen Hamoud and his 12-year-old brother Mustafa from Dearborn, Michigan, were trapped in Beirut during this past week of fighting. Last month, they traveled there to visit their grandparents, and they've been trying for the last few days to get back home to their parents. Their dad, Abed Hamoud, is a prosecutor in Wayne County in Michigan. He joins us on the line. And Abed, we understand you did get some good news today.
I would call it half good news because they made it to the area where the embassy is assembling people to evacuate. They made it to the boat. We know that, the first boat, the big one. But they're still right now, as we speak, in a port in Beirut. I feel much better when I know they are in Cyprus.
Are they on the cruise ship?
I think so. I don't know what kind of boat they are on. And the State Department told me to let them know to bring a lot of food and water with them, which means people anticipated the wait, and they did not anticipate them to be on some luxury liner.
Ah, so they may not be on the cruise ship. But either way, they're about to get on a vehicle that many people worry might be a big, fat target. Do you worry about that?
I don't trust the Israelis I don't put anything past the Israelis. I'm not worried the Lebanese will fire at that ship at all.
So you think, I mean, we must rush to say that many would debate that and say that Israelis have gone out of their way to send flyers in to tell civilians to leave areas and to not target civilians, but you do worry.
It's PR, yeah. They do a lot of PR. We know, we get news direct firsthand. They've been committing a lot of mini massacres in South Lebanon. They bomb homes with entire families in them. If Hezbollah did something to provoke Israel, which I'm going to assume for the sake of discussion, why doesn't Israel go and get the Hezbollah people out? Why do they need to bomb every bridge, every main road? They're destroying a country. You want Hezbollah, go get them.
Well, Abed Hamoun, how angry are you at Hezbollah for both provoking this fighting and historically hiding and putting its forces among civilians in Lebanon?
I am a prosecutor. When somebody pulls the trigger, I go after the person who pulled the trigger, not after the person who said, hey, how about this? I think that I'm angry at the Israelis who are bombing Lebanon right now. This is an excuse. Hezbollah took the two soldiers and the first day announced, we are willing to give them back immediately if you give us back the Lebanese held in Israel.
Well, what has this week been like for you, Abed Hamoud? Two small children, 10 and 12-year-old boys, visiting your parents. What has it been like for you to watch this unfold?
It's very difficult for me because it hits home, so to speak, to see the destruction of the country going so fast with my kids there. We knew that there could be problems when we send them there. I didn't want them to go because we were moving from one house to the other. I wanted their help, and they said, no, we want to spend the summer in Lebanon. We loved it. So they insisted, and I send them there. They have a lot of fun there. There's a beach. There's mountains. They go, there's a lot of freedom of movement, so speak for the kids, because they're in a village, they're not in a city like we are here. And to see this turning all of a sudden into a stranded situation that I'm helpless.
What are you going to do now? Do you wait in Dearborn? Do you go to Cyprus? What?
Right now the plan is to wait in Dearborn to see what is the plan on the other end. We know the State Department is doing all they can to evacuate people, and I'm really thankful to the professionals who are handling the evacuations. I disagree with the policies, but I'm very thankful to all the professionals who are working on this.
No, I want to stop you there because some people have been critical of the speed in which Americans have evacuated civilians, but others have understood the official response, which is the U.S. officials didn't want to telegraph where they were going to be sending Americans.
Yeah, if you ask the father in me, I would have rather than them doing this the first day of the operation than have my kids right now here. Mm-hmm. If you ask the engineer in me and the lawyer in me, I used to be an engineer, and I know that it takes a lot to do this work. I know I did see the French get out, and I was jealous when I saw the French get out. I wanted my kids on those first boats. But at the end of the day, they are professionals, government employees like myself. We all do our work with the best means we have. From my perspective, they're doing what they can. I don't know what kind of means they have, why they didn't move faster.
Mm-hmm. And Abed, just a quick thought. You're concerned about your parents, their grandparents. Are you going to try to get them out as well?
My mom is with the kids. My dad decided to stay for now.
Well, we hope you hear soon that your kids are closer to Dearborn.
I hope so, too. Thanks a lot.
And just ahead, we're going to check in Haifa and ask, what is Israel's plan? We'll ask the Consul General for Israel in New England. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. Here and now, we're continuing our coverage from the Middle East. We turn now to Israel. Amnon Reichman is a professor at the University of Haifa. Professor, the school is closed. What is the mood in Haifa?
Well, rather somber, naturally. We've been suffering from the rocket attack, so people are hunkered down.
And trying to explain, we understand, to kids what's going on. I was reading an account of a mother who was telling her child that the sounds were the Eggman dropping his eggs. What are some of the other ways that people in Haifa are trying to, you know, rationalize what's going on?
Well, kids in Haifa are pretty keen on learning exactly what's going on. So most people just tell the kids the truth that we've been attacked by the Hezbollah, basically, and that we have to respond so that we defend ourselves.
When you say hunkered down, are people not going out at all? What does it feel like there?
People are really going out only if necessary. So the streets are basically deserted almost all times. It's sad to see the streets so empty. On the other hand, people are resilient. You know, people have a sense that this is, at the end of the day, justified war. So it's a mixture of being sad and being stressed out with a strong sense of conviction, I'd say.
Is there any anger? Some say that the Israeli response to the Hezbollah capture and kidnapping of two Israeli soldiers and the missile attacks has been over the top.
Yeah, we're aware of that critique, and me as an academic, you know, I tend to be critical of basically everything, including the Israeli position. However, you can't live your life knowing that you're a hostage to someone else, and it's really sad that southern Lebanon and northern Israel are being, you know, they serve as the playing field for Iran and Syria, but I think people generally in Israel feel that this situation has to be stopped. I think at the end of the day, both Lebanese citizens and Israeli citizens are willing to live at peace.
Professor Amnon Reichman at the University of Haifa, which is closed because of the Hezbollah missiles attacking that city. Professor Reichman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And joining us now, Meir Shlomo, the Israeli Consul General to New England. Consul General Shlomo, what is Israel's plan? There are unconfirmed reports today of an agreement between the U.S. and Israel that Israel would continue the bombings for a week to weaken Hezbollah before Condoleezza Rice will go to the region. Is that true?
Well, the fact of the matter is that this whole crisis was imposed on us, and we have to look to see what is the root of this crisis. By now, there is a consensus in the international community that the root cause of this conflict is the Hezbollah.
Does Israel feel it's been given a tacit approval of its attacks against Lebanon?
Well, it's not about approval. It's about the situation. Hezbollah started this crisis by kidnapping two Israeli soldiers. We had no other alternative but to retaliate.
What is the attempt? Is it to neutralize, wipe out Hezbollah, or dismantle it as much as possible?
Well, the Hezbollah is one of the biggest terrorist organizations on the face of the planet.
But it's also a political party in Lebanon.
It's not a political party. It's mingled in the political politics. But have you ever heard about a political party who has its own army, who answers only to this party and not to anybody else? The fact is that this is a terrorist organization. And by the way, it had killed more than 300 Americans almost 10 years ago, or a little bit more than that.
In the bombing of the barracks.
Exactly. So this is a terrorist organization that has to be dealt with both militarily and politically.
Well, Consul General, on that point, it's been a week now since mm-hmm. Hezbollah militants captured the two Israeli soldiers during their cross-border raid. And there have reportedly been upwards of 300 casualties on the Lebanese side, dozens on the Israeli side. But the question, why isn't Israel doing a better job at avoiding civilian deaths, especially when the Lebanese people themselves are split in their feelings about Hezbollah? There are many people who are Lebanese who are angry about Hezbollah's unilateral action, and it's an opportunity to win hearts and minds. Instead, your critics say you're losing moderate Lebanese to Hezbollah's side.
Well, first of all, I must tell you that we regret every loss of life, whether it's Israeli or Lebanese or any other country, and no matter what religion he has. Unfortunately, the Hezbollah is an organization who operates from within populated centers to use them as a shelter. So we are using everything we can. We leaflet the places. We ask people to leave beforehand if we know that we are in the vicinity of a civilian population, and we lose a lot of the surprise military advantage by that, but we do it.
Council General Shlomo, you said that this is Israel is only responding to Hezbollah's unilateral action. Hezbollah would say that it performed its cross-border raid in support of Palestinians in Gaza. Israel still engaged in skirmishes in Gaza and trying to retrieve an Israeli soldier there. Is there any concern that, as a Boston Globe editorial recently said, Israel is just stepping right into a trap laid for it by Iran, that both of these actions, the kidnapping in Gaza and on the Lebanese border, were set up by Iran to provoke Israel for just this kind of response so that the civilian death toll mounts and there's disorder in the region?
Well, there's some truth into it in the sense that Iran, we suspect that Iran is heavily involved and has to do a lot with the timing of these two attacks, both by Hamas and Hezbollah. However, this is a symptom. Hezbollah would not have been able to do it if it would not have been allowed to operate in the last 6 years and build its infrastructure in South Lebanon.
Do you worry that these actions now are going to so destabilize the fragile new Lebanese government that in its collapse, Hezbollah becomes even stronger?
We are very supportive of a strong, independent Lebanese government, and we wish not Lebanon and not the Lebanese government any harm. Having said so, if you are a leader, you also have a responsibility and not just a job. And that means that if you have a conviction that moderation is the call of the day and that Hezbollah is an anti-Lebanese organization, you shouldn't only tell it in four eyes to your visitors. You should put it publicly and take a stand on that. And that's what leaders are supposed to do. And much of what's happening now in Lebanon is the inaction and the lack of political courage, and if I may say so, even personal courage, of the Lebanese leaders to call a spade a spade.
Mayor Shlomo, Israeli Consul General for New England. Consul General Shlomo, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, we'll continue to follow the news from the Middle East for you over the course of the program. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Here and Now. In California, the nation's largest prison system, a legislative battle is raging over prison reform, and one of the sticking points, transferring female inmates from overcrowded prisons to locked detention centers closer to their families and to drug and alcohol treatment. It's an issue many states are privately debating. There are five times as many women in American prisons than there were two decades ago, with almost two-thirds of them convicted of nonviolent offenses. That leaves 1.3 million children with a mother in jail. Investigative journalist Christina Rathbone spent 5 years following women doing time inside MCI Framingham here in Massachusetts. It's the oldest running women's prison in the country. She chronicled that experience in A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. That book is now out in paperback, and author Christina Rathbone joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, I have to say that, you know, I began reading your book a little tired, a little cranky, and thinking, another predictable sob story about convicts hoping to, you know, play on my sympathies. Then I came to your historical comparisons. Just tell us in an overarching thought what you found when you looked back at women in prisons, you know, a couple hundred years ago as compared to today.
Very little has changed since the 19th century when women were first given their own prisons, as opposed to being stashed away in attics and cellars of men's prisons. Then, as now, the vast majority of women serving time are serving time for nonviolent offences and for the types of offences that men are typically not incarcerated for at all.
Yeah.
So that in the 19th century, the vast majority of women were serving time for crimes pretty much against themselves, crimes having to do with sexual activity and with abuse of drugs and alcohol, and the same is true today.
Well, let's pick a year. For instance, let's go back to 1882. 221 were there for nonviolent offenses, 97 for being drunk, 29 for prostitution, 14 for idleness, 13 for being lewd, 11 for being stubborn, 6 yeah. for vagrancy, 5 for adultery. So few for violent crimes.
It's really remarkable. I mean, when I first found these statistics in the Massachusetts State Archives, I thought I was reading these logbooks wrong because they seemed like descriptions of the women who were there. You know, this woman was stubborn. But no, these were, in fact, the crimes for which they were convicted.
Well, what kinds of crimes are women in prison for now?
You know, when I last checked, which was several months ago, 67% of the women serving time in prison in Massachusetts, and it's the same pretty much across the nation, are serving time for nonviolent crimes. Women are serving time predominantly still for drug-related crimes, and the main impetus for this huge increase is because of these mandatory sentences, which put women away for huge amounts of time for what is often and typically minimal involvement in drug-related crime.
And many of those women have children. Now, you followed Denise Russell, a 32-year-old woman from New Bedford, Massachusetts. She was an exotic dancer and a crack addict. She had a son with an abusive, mentally ill man. Her 9-year-old son, Patrick, then goes to live with that man. And she does ultimately get to have visits with the boy in another institution in what's called the trailer. This is where women get 24 hours in a trailer with their children. On rare occasions, and it's heartbreaking for them.
You know, the irony is that these moments of meeting with their children, while of course worth more than anything in prison, are also very, very painful, because if you're separate from your children, at least you can kind of separate internally from them and try to keep going, if only for their sake. If suddenly they become real again, only for 24 or 36 hours, then the pain of leaving is just picking away at that wound, both for the child and the mother. But of course, most women in prison across the country report not seeing their children even once from the time that they're incarcerated. This has a lot to do with the fact that there are fewer women in prisons in the country, and so they're further away from their families. Their families are typically overworked and underfinanced. The traveling costs are prohibitive for many families, and women simply just don't see their children when they're away. Patrick, the son of Denise, who was 9 when she was sent away, was abused by his father while she was gone, and then moved to the foster system, and there was bounced from house to house to such a degree that when a social worker told him he had to get in trouble to be moved, he did just that and started a shoplifting spree. And the terrible, cruel irony is he was in a detention center by the time she was finally released, 5 years and a day after she was sent away.
What would you recommend happen with women with children? What should children be in prison more with their mothers? I mean, some would say that could be equally disastrous.
You know, in the mid-20th century, when a woman named Miriam Van Waters was the superintendent of Framingham, there was a program that the babies born to women in prison and women who had young children stayed with their children for up to 2 years. Now, that could sound horrific, except that where they stayed was a wonderful place, with no bars on the windows, no locks on the doors, and a place that was extremely well-staffed with trained and capable assistants helping the mothers learn how to mother their children. And by the time the mother was released, it was very easy for a family to recreate itself. There is nothing now in Massachusetts, no way for a mother to maintain contact with their child in any dependable way, except for these occasional trailer visits and visits in the visiting room, which last 2 or 3 or 4 hours if the woman can find someone to bring their child to meet with them. This is in no way useful. And I'm not thinking primarily of the mother, but of the child now. When you're a young child and your mother disappears, it's extremely hard to understand why. Why your mother can't come home. That's what I heard over and over again. And increased visitation, having some kind of thread continue of relationship between mother and child, helps that child in their schooling, helps them in their social interactions with other adults and with their peers, and prevents them in the long run from getting involved in the criminal justice system themselves. Mm.
You fought long and hard to get in to see a program of Girl Scouts that was carried out at the prison. What does that program do?
Girl Scouts Beyond Bars is actually a national program run by the Girl Scouts, which brings daughters of women in prison to have a Girl Scout meeting with their mothers in prison. It enables the mothers to take on leadership roles by having them lead these Girl Scout meetings. The Girl Scout meetings are just as you would imagine Girl Scout meetings being anywhere. They work towards badges. It's just like as if it was happening in the community, in any church hall, anywhere. It's a guaranteed biweekly visit from your daughter with the mother. And it's just a wonderful source of support for those girls, many of whom have been taught to be very ashamed of where their mothers are, who don't speak of it, or have even been instructed not to speak of it to anyone. And this is the first time they can really be open about what their real life situations are.
Well, Christina Rathbone, there have been some changes at MCI Framingham since you wrote this book. But you say that we should reduce the number of women in prison under mandatory drug laws and that they need educational programs. How do you answer people who say, you know, little compassion fatigue, these women have committed crimes and they should just do the time?
It might be in some way beneficial for us to believe that by throwing them in prison and throwing away the key, we're doing some kind of good for society. But actually, we're doing no good for ourselves or for the women. So if they have to be in prison, have them at least be in a position where they can improve themselves and improve their futures, and especially improve the futures of their children.
Christina Rathbone. Again, her book is A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. It's now out in paperback. To see a photo essay of women and their children in prison, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And Christina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. Scientists around the world are tapping into ancient climate records trapped in tropical ice glaciers to try and track climate change over the past 5,000 years. And they say their research is coming to an alarming conclusion that most of the world's high-altitude glaciers will disappear in the near future. What does that mean for global climate change? Science reporter Daniel Grossman is spending the year traveling to the globe's melting ice formations. We last spoke to him in May from Greenland's ice sheets, and today he joins us on a satellite phone from the base of the Cocaya ice cap in Peru. Dan, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm fine. First of all, can you tell us what you see? What are you looking at?
This is the largest tropical glacier in the world. It's about 8 miles long and a couple of miles wide, and it starts at about 17,000 feet where I am, and it's sort of like a dome of ice, and at the top it's about 18,500 feet. And from here, I'm just going to turn so I can see it. It's what I can see is this panorama of white ice at the bottom, towards the bottom. It's kind of dirty and rough, has a rough texture where it's melted, and toward the top where it's colder, it's smoother and whiter.
Well, we know you're on this expedition with Lonnie Thompson, an Ohio State University paleoclimatologist. He's spent the last 31 years studying the ice fields atop many of the world's highest peaks. We understand that the scientists are learning about climate change through the plants that were frozen about 5,000 years ago.
A few years ago, he noticed that as the glacier is retreating, and the glacier is getting smaller, it is retreating, there were plant remains that were melting out at the base of the glacier. No one had ever observed this kind of thing before in other glaciers. I think you have to have just the right conditions. And so he dated these plants, and he's found many samples of plants that are about 5,000 or 6,000 years old. And what he concludes from that is that the last time the glacier was as small as it is today was about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago.
So can I extrapolate that he's coming to the conclusion that in that area it hasn't been as warm as it is now for about 5,000 to 6,000 years?
At least 5,000 or 6,000 years.
And what does it mean to this scientist that, you know, that fact is true? What would that mean to him?
Well, it means a number of things. For the people of Peru, Peru has more tropical glaciers than any country in the world. And so there will be big impacts here in Peru on melting of glaciers. Glaciers, they really are like a canary in the mine. They really show you that something is going on. Glaciers play a very important role in storing water and releasing the water at a different time. So during the cold and wet season, the snow falls on the glacier and it gets stored. It's like a reservoir or a bank account. And then later on in the year, that water melts and it feeds rivers. Industries rely on rivers. As glaciers melt, they're going to have to adapt somehow. In addition to the plant material that I was telling you about, he's been coming here for a couple of decades and he's been recording what he's seen every year. And we went to the largest outlet glacier, and it's been retreating at about 100 feet a year. There are new lakes that are being formed. There are places in the glacier where last year there was basically like a little mountain of ice, and this year there's a hole.
Science reporter Daniel Grossman, we never know where he's going to show up. Today, speaking from the base of the Calcaya ice cap in Peru, and on an expedition measuring melting tropical glacier there. Daniel, what's next?
In the fall, I'm going to the Arctic Ocean to look at Arctic sea ice.
Well, we'll speak to you then. Daniel, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Take advice. Someday you'll pay the price. I
Now, and after all the bleak news of the day, we thought we'd have a moment of beauty.
My life is brilliant. My love is pure. I saw an angel of that I'm sure. She smiled at me on the subway. She was with another man. But I won't lose no sleep on that, 'cause I've got a plan. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. It's true.
But then again, maybe you're screaming, oh no, not that song again. British singing sensation James Blunt, a former army lieutenant who served in Kosovo, topped the British pop charts with You're Beautiful, his melancholy anthem to a former girlfriend he glimpsed on a train with a new boyfriend. Then the song became the first British song to top the U.S. pop charts in 9 years. But then came the perhaps inevitable backlash. A station in southern Essex in Britain swore off playing You're Beautiful. Blunt himself has called it the most overplayed record of the year. And now James Blunt has reached what Boston Globe pop critic Sarah Rodman has called the fifth stage of pop hitdom, the parody. And Sarah joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Go through us, please, what you call the five stages of hitdom.
Absolutely. The five stages of pop hitdom are, hey, what's that new song? That would be stage one. Stage two is, I love that new song. Stage three for the hipsters is, oh, you just discovered that song? I heard that song months ago. Stage four is, why won't they stop playing that song? And stage five finally is, wow, have you heard the hilarious spoof of that song? And that's where James Blunt is now.
And that's where we are, the parody. We have a few of them lined up. They seem to parody not only the song, but the video. So tell us quickly about the video.
Well, in the video, he is, for some reason, standing on a cliffside in the drizzly rain and snow, and he starts disrobing. He's so beautiful, he's been moved to take off his clothes and jump into the ocean.
Okay, and so Weird Al Yankovic comes to the fore. We know he's parodied everyone from Madonna. His Like a Surgeon took off on Like a Virgin. Fat took off on Michael Jackson's Bad. So let us listen now to his thoughts on the James Blunt song. James Blunt again is You're Beautiful. Weird Al's is You're Pitiful.
My life is brilliant.
What? Was I too early? Oh, sorry. Should I? Do you want to start over or keep going?
My life is brilliant. Your life's a joke. You're just pathetic. You're always broke. Your homemade Star Trek uniform really ain't impressing me. You're suffering from delusions of adequacy.
So, okay, first of all, Weird Al parodies the fact that people think James Blunt just sort of started the song too early.
Right, exactly. It sounds like he should have waited another, you know, eight bars to come in again, and so he just pretends like he was supposed to be singing at that point.
And then Weird Al goes on to poke fun at sci-fi geeks, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, now, the interesting thing about Weird Al's song is that he says he got permission from James Blunt to do it.
Yes, he always does that. Weird Al goes out of his way to get permission from artists, but apparently the record company was not so hot on the idea. And so he's only made it available as an MP3. It will not be on his forthcoming album.
But people still can download it. It's all over the web.
Yeah, and it's on Weird Al's website.
Okay. Our favorite is My Cubicle.
Yes.
It's an ode to the cubicle life. Let's listen.
My cubicle. My cubicle. It's one of 62. It's my small space. Just a 6x6 board booth. And I hate it, that's the truth.
I love it. Now, you searched on the web to find these. What
yes.
did you think when you found this one?
I actually thought two things. The guy's a pretty good singer, and it's really kind of sad. Like, it's sadder than the actual song.
Do we know who this is?
We don't. There was no, I could not find a name for this guy anywhere.
Another version you found, You're Gullible. But it says on the site that it can't be downloaded.
Which is playing on the You're Gullible theme, because apparently it actually can be. The song title comes from they're accusing fans of the song of being gullible, because in this person's opinion, actually the song is no good, and the masses have just latched onto it because they have been told that it's good.
So You're Gullible is not the subject of a legal threat from one of Mr. Blunt's publishers?
I mean, I suppose it could be, but I think that's more to play along with the song.
Then let's listen.
My voice is silly and my songs are poor. You keep on listening to this manure. The press say I'm a genius, and you'll never question that. Just keep on buying my CD, although it's utter crap.
Poor James Blunt, by the way.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that we should have much pity for James Blunt, because once you reach the stage, this means your song has been a hit. So, and I interviewed him a few months ago, and he says he thinks it's brilliant, to use his word, that these people are parodying him, because he knows that means he's been successful. He thinks it's very funny.
Well, let's move on to She Was Beautiful, I Swear. Tell us about that parody.
This one is one that's available on YouTube and also on the artist's website, kevinsage.com. It's actually a video as well.
It's
the somewhat sordid tale of a man who thinks a woman is beautiful and then he gets her home to find out that she is not, in fact, a woman.
It's sort of like a Lola.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. But it's very funny. He's disrobing in the video, and one of the great moments is he takes off his pants and all the change falls out of his pockets.
She was beautiful. She was beautiful. She was beautiful. I swear. When I saw her face, it was in a crowded place. And I didn't see the bump right here. I shouldn't have drank so much beer.
You know, Sarah Rodman, I'm thinking, what's in it for these guys? They do so much work. They put these together. Do they make any money off of it? Or
I doubt they make any money, but we're sitting here talking about them, aren't we?
Right. But we don't really know who they are or much else about them. It seems like such pure creativity.
I think for some people it is. And for the My Cubicle person, for instance, who hasn't made his name public, you know, he just was probably sitting in his cube and wanting to waste time, and this is what he did. For the She Was Beautiful, I Swear, gentleman Kevin's age, I think he's an actor and a writer, and he has a website, and he allowed his video to be on YouTube. And I think they're just trying to draw, you know, people to their sites and draw attention to themselves.
Well, you know, I never thought it could happen. I once really liked this song, but after hearing all of these introductions over and over again, I think I have also probably, you know, peaked on You're Beautiful. But you say there's good news for people who love James Blunt and maybe are getting a little tired of that song.
Well, of course, the original good news would be they could buy the record and listen to the rest of the songs and perhaps skip that one. There's a new single out called High that is doing fairly well in this country. Goodbye, My Lover, which is a deeper cut on the record, is a huge favorite in concert. All the women sing along to this very sort of devotional song to a lost love, and that one's quite beautiful, to steal James Blunt's word.
You can't. There's no getting away from it. It's in our dreams.
It is.
Sarah Rodman of the Boston Globe talking about the parodies of James Blunt's You're Beautiful. By the way, the name of the CD is?
Back to Bedlam.
And get that, and perhaps wean yourself off of You're Beautiful. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Goodbye, my lover. Goodbye, my friend. You have been the one. You have been the one for me.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.